From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. In the first part of today's show, we'll speak with Dave Golson. Golson is a professor of biology at University of Sussex, who has published more than 300 scientific articles on the ecology and conservation of bumblebees and other insects.
Professor Golson has just released a new book called Silent Earth, Averting the Insect Apocalypse. He'll discuss the dramatic worldwide decline of insect species and how this can directly impact all life on Earth, including ours. He'll also talk about some of the many simple and powerful things we can all do at home to slow or reverse this trend.
Then in the second half of the show, we'll speak with environmental professor and author John Francis. Francis's environmental work began in 1971 when he witnessed an oil spill in San Francisco Bay. It was then that he gave up the use of motorized vehicles and began to walk everywhere. He started walking because he felt partly responsible for the mess that washed up on the shore.
Several months later, on his 27th birthday, fed up with the arguments his decision to walk seemed to create with his friends, John took a vow of silence lasting 17 years. During that time, he founded Planet Walk, a nonprofit environmental awareness organization, while receiving multiple degrees, including a PhD in land resources from the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
John Francis joins us in the second part of the show to talk about his book, Planet Walker, 17 Years of Silence, 22 Years of Walking, and his new children's book titled Human Kindness, True Stories of Compassion and Generosity That Changed the World.
Environmental awareness and education. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us now for the first part of today's show is Professor Dave Golson. He's a professor of biology at the University of Sussex, and he's published more than 300 scientific articles on the ecology and conservation of bumblebees and other insects. Today we'll be speaking to him about his new book called Silent Earth, Averting the Insect Apocalypse. Professor Golson, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Well, we're always interested to hear from the authors and scientists that we speak with. How did you start in your field? How did you get interested in insects?
I always have been. It's actually quite hard to explain because when I was only, I guess, 5 or 6 years old, I just thought they were really cool. And I used to collect grasshoppers and caterpillars and keep them in jam jars and you know, your Tupperware boxes,
sure,
or whatever, and I've basically been hooked ever since.
It's funny how those childhood interests can somehow become a career over a few decades.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm really lucky. You know, there's not many people that manage to make a career out of their childhood hobby, and I still sometimes can't quite believe that I get paid to run around catching insects.
The best part of the job. Well, we might
Absolutely. We might
ignore the data analysis portion for the moment and yeah, focus on the field work. Just
the joy of being outdoors and chasing down insects all around the world, right?
Yeah, I guess I've been lucky over the years and managed to find excuses to travel pretty widely in search of particular interesting insects from, I guess, yeah, the southern Andes of Argentina to New Zealand and Borneo and all over. And some, I mean, the world is full of the most amazing, weird, and wonderful insects.
Well, let's talk about insects. I know that's a broad topic, but, you know, this whole book is about insects and their populations and what we can do. Why do we, you know, care about insects? What are the roles that they play in our ecosystems and in our world?
Yeah, so insects are incredibly important, and I think most people don't appreciate this at all. In fact, actually, many people don't really like insects, I have to admit. but they should, because we depend on them. They make up the bulk of life on Earth in terms of numbers of species. They're food for thousands of species of birds, bats, fish, amphibians, reptiles like lizards and so on. But then they perform all sorts of really important kind of ecosystem functions, sometimes called ecosystem services by scientists. But basically, they do things that need doing, like recycling cowpats and dead bodies and leaves and tree trunks. And that recycling process is really important. And they help to keep the soil healthy. They help to control pests of crops. And perhaps the thing that's best known is they pollinate. About 80% of all the plant species on our planet need pollinating by insects. And about 3/4 of all the crops we grow wouldn't give a good harvest without insect pollinators. So, you know, we have very selfish reasons to want to look after these little creatures.
You mentioned that they make up the bulk of life on Earth as far as number of species. Give us a sketch here of how many different species of insects we have in our world.
Yeah, so we've named about 1.1 million species of insect, out of about 1.5 million species of everything that we know of.
Okay.
So it's about 70% of all known life forms are insects. But the really cool thing is that new ones are discovered all the time, and it's estimated there may be another 4 or 5 million species of insect that we haven't yet found, which is pretty mind-boggling.
So we've only identified less than 20% around of what's estimated to be out there in terms of species.
Yeah, exactly. So we've just scratched the surface. You know, who knows what amazing beasties might still be waiting discovery.
How many have you've discovered or had a hand in discovering?
I wish I could claim to have discovered a single insect, but it's not really my... unfortunately, living in Britain, we've probably got most of our insects kind of named. You really need to go to the less well-studied parts of the world. You know, if you go to South America, Africa, and flap around with a butterfly net, you'll pretty quickly find new species. The art, though, the real trick is knowing which ones are the new ones. It's a really specialist job, because basically you have to know about the 1.1 million species we've already named before you can rule those out and know you've found a new one.
It's incredible. It is a little mind-boggling to think about that number and the level of knowledge that you need to take that on. So when we think about, you know, what we know about insects, which I guess in some ways is relatively little, how much do we know about the population trends that we're seeing with them? We know that there's a decline that you and many others are studying. What does that look like?
Yeah, on to the depressing stuff. So there are big knowledge gaps, I guess it's best to acknowledge up front. Most insects we haven't even named, as I said, and of the ones we have got names for, the large majority, nobody counts regularly. We don't have numbers as to how they're doing. But we do have monitoring schemes for some insects in some parts of the world. And they almost all show really strong negative trends. So, for example, in the UK here, butterfly populations have fallen by about 50% since 1976 when I was a kid, running around catching them. In Germany, flying insect populations are down 76% in the last 27 years. So 3/4 of the German insects seem to have vanished. In North America, the monarch butterfly was this famous sort of iconic, beautiful butterfly, down about 80% since the mid-1990s. So those are just a few examples. There are many more, but they nearly all show the same pattern that, you know, insects do seem to be in big trouble.
And with respect to butterflies, besides being, you know, beautiful and colorful and fun to watch and identify, they're important pollinators. Like you say, they are an example of an insect that plays a really important role in our health and welfare.
Yeah, I mean, pollination alone, you know, if it weren't for those insect pollinators, people would be starving, you know. We wouldn't have enough food to go around. And it's particularly all the healthy stuff that insects pollinate. So fruits and vegetables in particular are, they're nearly all insect pollinated, everything from apples, blueberries, strawberries, tomatoes, chili peppers, squashes, even things like like coffee and chocolate are insect pollinators. So imagine life without them. It doesn't bear thinking about, really.
Do we know when this trend started? Do we have, you know, older data or historic data where we could sort of track some of these declines that we're looking at more closely now?
No, that's one of the sort of worrying aspects of this is that I mentioned 1976 for British butterflies. That's actually the earliest insect monitoring scheme that exists. Mm. So we don't have any data prior to that point from anywhere in the world.
Mm. Okay.
And it's a pretty good guess that insects started declining before 1976. loss of habitat, the sort of industrialization of farming, the invention of pesticides and so on, they all predate that by a long time. So it's probable that we're just kind of looking at the tail end of bigger declines, but we honestly don't know.
So when we kind of like look, you know, at these pretty shocking, I guess, declines in numbers, do we know what's causing them? Can we figure that out?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's there's more than one reason. It's a whole bunch of factors. We're still destroying insect-rich habitats, particularly in the tropics, rainforests, and so on. And that's disastrous because that's a habitat that's really rich in insect life. Farming has changed pretty dramatically in the last 100 years and becomes much more kind of industrialized with big monocultures of crops sprayed with lots of insecticides. And their farmland has become quite hostile to insects, so that's impacting them in a big way. But then there's a whole bunch of other things. Climate change is starting to kick in. Invasive species create problems. Light pollution is perhaps one of the less well-known aspects of these problems we're creating, that all the lights we have on at night confuse and disorientate nocturnal insects. And there's other things too, but it's like a kind of perfect storm. You know, insects are pretty tough and they've been around for 480 million years. You know, that's twice as long as the oldest dinosaurs. And they survived the mass extinctions that wiped out the dinosaurs and other creatures in Earth's history. But, you know, now they're in trouble and it's all sadly down to us.
So what are the, what might you say are insects that maybe are, I don't know, doing well, let's say, or or actually proliferating in this Anthropocene? Yeah.
Yeah, there are some. Unfortunately, they tend to be a minority. And sadly, actually, they tend to be the ones that we'd perhaps rather didn't proliferate.
Yes.
So, for example, things like houseflies that they breed in human waste, in landfill sites and rubbish and excrement and so on, and they spread disease. They're pretty tough and adaptable. They're doing okay. Cockroaches, likewise, you know, they're not in any danger whatsoever. Mosquitoes breed in all puddles, in refuse and so on. And climate change is enabling some of the more serious disease-carrying mosquitoes, including things like yellow fever and malaria, spreading into the cooler parts of the Northern Hemisphere as these insects thrive. So there are insects that are doing okay, doing more than okay, in fact. But unfortunately, they're not the pollinators or the insects that we'd perhaps like to be thriving.
Right. And in the process of trying to manage or control or eradicate them, there is the knock-on effects that spraying pesticides of one form or another may control cockroaches or mosquito populations, but you're also doing damage to bees and butterflies and other, there's a lot of collateral damage associated with that.
Huge collateral damage. You know, and there are some horrific examples. For example, to try and control Zika virus, insecticides in recent years have been sprayed from the air onto entire cities in the USA, And these are pretty potent insecticides, a slight concern for human health, but certainly from the point of view of all the other insect life, you know, the thousands of other species of insect that would be present. These insecticides, sadly, we haven't invented insecticides that just kill the bad insects, as it were. They just kill the whole lot. So exactly, those, you know, monarch butterflies that happen to be flying through, bees, anything like that is going to be killed just as effectively as the mosquitoes. So we're pretty clumsy, you know, we're heavy-handed, and we need to somehow find a way to tread more lightly on our planet, I think.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Professor Dave Golson, who's a professor of biology at the University of Sussex, and incredibly broadly published on ecology and conservation of bumblebees and insects. And we're talking about his new book, Silent Earth, Averting the Insect Apocalypse. So while we have shared, you know, some, I guess, some hard news or some bad news about these trends that we're seeing with insects, you point out that there's much that we can do in and around our own homes and communities. And I love that perspective of sort of, you know, it may be hard for us to save, you know, whatever, the snow leopards or the jaguars or, you know, species like this, but there is a lot that we can do to save these insects that live near us. So, you know, you make such a great encouraging point with that. Where do you encourage people to start?
Yeah, well, start close to home, you know, and it's great that, you know, as you say, a lot of these sort of big environmental issues, you feel pretty helpless. Climate change and, you know, the rainforests and so on. But insects, they live in our backyards, they live in the local park, they're pretty much everywhere. And they can breed really quickly, they can recover remarkably quickly, you know, compared to, say, giant pandas, which are very slow to reproduce. Insects, you know, can spring back. We just need to provide them with some habitat. And if you're lucky enough to have a yard of your own, a bit of outdoor space, then you can have thousands of species of insect living there. And that isn't just a figure of speech. Literally thousands of species will live in an urban garden. If you just grow native wildflowers, don't spray pesticides, maybe you put in a little pond, a compost heap, plant some flowering trees, really simple things. I've got a YouTube channel with advice if people are interested to find out more.
Absolutely.
Grow less grass.
Yeah, mowing is hopeless.
We grow way too much grass in this Utah town of ours. That doesn't need to
be
there.
Yeah, it's the human kind of desire to have a kind of, you know, Wimbledon tennis court style kind of striped grass lawn. It is very counterproductive from a wildlife point of view. They don't really support much in the way of wildlife at all, sadly.
We call it flyover country. If you're a bee, it's flyover country, right? There's nothing there for you.
Nothing there. And worse still is this growing trend to put down plastic grass, certainly in the UK, really depresses the hell out of me, I have to say. But on the other hand, you know, if you turn that into a wildflower meadow, you don't cut it more than a couple of times a year, and it can be beautiful. You can be your own little meadow. Full of bees and butterflies and grasshoppers and all sorts of other creatures.
And I think you've put this to work in your own home, right? With a garden?
Yeah. I'm really lucky. We live on the edge of a village, and I've got about 2 acres of garden, and it's all organic. I don't use any pesticides. It's full of bee-friendly flowers. And I mean, it's really easy, and it's so rewarding to, you know, just go on a warm day in the summer and just go outside, and you can see all the life, hear all the life, the buzzing of the bees and the grasshoppers chirping in the grass and so on. And I just absolutely love it. And I wish I could persuade everyone else of just what a, you know, a satisfying, rewarding thing it is to do, to garden for nature.
You know, last week we had on the show the rare plants coordinator for the state of Utah, and she is running a new pollinator habitat grant program. And we said, what does success look like to you, thinking that there would be some numbers or some data? And she described what you just described, the same thing. She said, if you can walk into your garden or into the area where you've planted these plants and you can see different kinds of insects and wildlife, you know, buzzing around and using them, then I think that's success. And I thought that was so cool because that doesn't take any, you know, complex metrics or anything to look at. You know, it just takes some observation.
Yeah, and I think it's also really important that we do this for our kids, you know, so that children grow up familiar with insects. If every yard was full of insects and kids, you know, grew up seeing bumblebees and all these other insects every day, then they wouldn't ever become frightened of them. One of the really sad features I find of the modern world is that most teenagers and adults, if an insect buzzes towards them, their immediate reaction is terror. You know, they think this thing is going to attack them, sting them, bite them or whatever, give them a disease. I don't really know where the fright comes from, but I think that partly stems from lack of familiarity. And actually, if you get to know them, if you spend time with them from an early age, like I did, you know, they're really fascinating, beautiful, lovable creatures. And so I think it's really important that we try to give our kids from an early age the chance to engage with insects.
Well, I can say I know where, on a personal level, where that negative attitude came towards insects growing up in the 60s and 70s and having parents who grew up in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Like you said, Dave, every insect was seen as a threat, maybe except for a butterfly or something. Every bee was a threat to me. Or seen as a threat. And of course, DuPont and Monsanto and that ilk did their best to kind of promote that fear as well. And while you're at it, buy our insecticide and pesticide to control these quote unquote threats. And so there's generations that were, you know, educated or so, taught to see insects as threats like that. Harmful.
Yeah, of course, it's almost exactly 60 years since Rachel Carson published Silent Spring,
right?
Which is kind of where the title of my book borrows from, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Rachel was the first person to really highlight that these pesticides, which really appeared in the 1940s, just after the Second World War. By the early 1960s, it was clear that they were harmful to the environment. But we were already hooked, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And although her campaigning and her book made people more aware of the issue and led to the banning of things like DDT, the worst pesticides that were available back then, the industry has just expanded and proliferated. And the number of pesticides is massively greater now than it was in her day. I think the figure is that when she published Silent Earth, there were about 37 pesticides available in the United States, and now there's about 1,000. So I think she'd be rather depressed if she saw how things had turned out.
But there wasn't shows like ours back then, This Green Earth, and the work you do. I mean, not to be flip, but I mean, there on the other side, there are those of us who are making efforts to try to change minds.
There are great things happening in the world. You know, awareness of the environmental problems we've been talking about, insect declines, and actually also a awareness that insects are valuable, particularly bees and through pollination, is much greater than it used to be. And that's, you know, that is encouraging. And I think if we can continue the spread of that kind of message, I think, you know, we just need to persuade people to value and respect our fellow creatures on this planet. And as you said, you know, there was an era when we just seemed to want to kill everything that was even the tiniest bit inconvenient to us. And we need to move away from that. I you know, I think every species on this planet has as much right to live here as we do, whether it's an earwig or a woodlouse or whatever it might be.
Amen.
I love that. I love that perspective. And I think we will leave it at that. I want to ask you to remind us where we can find your book and also find you on YouTube.
Just look for Dave Goulson on YouTube and you'll find me very easily. My book, Silent Earth, is published by... my brain's just stopped working.
That's what Live Radio is for.
HarperCollins, of course. HarperCollins.
HarperCollins.
And all good bookshops.
Fantastic. Well, that's Professor Dave Goulson with the University of Sussex. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. And we'll be looking for your next book.
Look forward to joining you again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back for the second half of the show to speak with author John Francis.
Yes, he's the author of the book Planet Walker, 17 Years of Silence, 22 Years of Walking, and a new children's book titled Human Kindness, True Stories of Compassion and Generosity That Changed the World. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back. Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us for the second part of this show is Professor John Francis. He is the author, among other things, he is the author of the book Planet Walker, 17 Years of Silence, 22 Years of Walking, and also the author of a new children's book titled Human Kindness, True Stories of Compassion and Generosity That Changed the World. John Francis, thank you so much for joining Nell and myself on This Green Earth this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning. It's 1971, you're 26 or 27. We talked about in the intro, an oil spill kind of changed your life, but what were you doing with your life before this oil spill?
Well, I was actually a band manager for a avant-garde jazz group. Yeah, and you know, just kind of living the life in California of trying to look for the revolution, the cultural revolution that was supposed to be happening, and that kind of fizzled out there.
Okay, but in its place, unfortunately, there is an oil spill, a tanker collision or so, oil spill. You go out, as I understand, to help clean up this mess as best you can. And what comes of that?
Well, I just went out with my girlfriend. We wanted to look and see at a spill. So we drove from our little town, the 40 miles to San Francisco, and across the Golden Gate Bridge. And thankfully, it was all fogged in, so we really couldn't see it. And so we drove across the city, and we're on our way back, and we're going past where the spill, people are, you know, rushing out to save birds and things. And someone on the radio, radio is a big thing back then, and someone on the radio says, look,
John, it still is, okay? Just work with us. Sorry.
I believe you. For me, it is.
Yes, know? Okay, and sorry.
All right.
Now that I'm speaking, it's very good.
Exactly.
an announcer says, look, if you don't like the news, go out and make your own. And I thought, that's kind of a challenge. And we drove back to our little town, and I couldn't figure out what it was I was going to do to really help the oil spill to mitigate that. And I said to my girlfriend, I said, maybe we should just give up riding in cars. And she kind of laughed at me and said, that's really sweet of you, John. You're so naive. It's kind of why I like you. And it wasn't very much after that a friend's death convinced me that, you know, you only have this moment to do the things that you say you want to do. There's no guarantee that tomorrow's going to come. There's no guarantee that, you know, you're going to win the lottery or the money's going to come so that you can afford to do the things that you feel you need to do. And so on that day that my friend passed away in a boating accident, actually on Tamales Bay, which is a little bay near where I lived, my girlfriend and I decided we were going to walk to the next big town, which was San Anselmo, about 20 miles away, to dance in his honor. And we got there. It took us all day to get there.
Right.
Once we got there, they were just about over. They were singing the last song, and it was the Young Bloods who lived in our town, and they were singing, "Come on, people, smile on your brother."
Oh, wow.
"Everybody get together," you know, that this
yes.
song, "Get
mm-hmm.
Together." And they said, "Yeah, John, Gene, you guys just walked all the way." And we said, "Yeah, yeah." And they said, "Well, we'll drive you back home." And we decided, no, we would walk back. And on that walk the next day is when I realized that, you know, if I was going to do anything, I was going to do it now, because my friend who passed away was my age. He was about 26 and, you know, was a deputy sheriff. He had a wife, a family, and a house with a white picket fence around it, you know. It was like the American dream, right? Mm. And he was white. And that should tell you that I'm African American,
right?
Black. So he had everything, and just like that, he was gone. And it made me think, like, wow, John, tomorrow you might not be here. So what are you going to do? And I said, you know, I'm going to keep walking.
Mm.
And that's what happened. I just kept walking. Yeah.
And okay, so you walk everywhere, and obviously you have to at times try to explain yourself why you're doing this. And I'm sure you get people again who think you're naive, and that's kind of a nice idea, but it's not going to amount to anything. And so eventually you get kind of fed up with these conversations, so to speak.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm always arguing about, you know, what it is I'm doing. And I think that, you know, I say, you know, one person walking can make a difference. And that's the kind of, oh, John, you're really crazy guy. That's not how life works. And you're just going to end up walking. And that means more gas for us. That's probably true. I just didn't know. And I said, I'm going to just shut up for one day on my birthday. I was turning 27. And I thought, I've been reading a lot of books on Eastern philosophy. And I learned about Mahir Baba, who didn't speak for 40 years. And I said, well, I can't do that, but I can do it for one day. And so I did. I shut up for one day. And that was just so enlightening to me. It was like going through a door, because I learned that I had not really been listening. What I would do was just listen enough to think that I understood or knew what the other person was going to say. And then I would stop listening and start thinking in my own mind what I was going to say back to them, as to show them that they were wrong, I knew the right answer. And even if what they were going to say was what I believe, I could say it better. Hmm. And that one day taught me that, you know, John, you've been listening shallowly, very, you know, for a long time, and you have stopped learning. Because if you think you know everything, anything that's different, you don't want to hear it,
sure.
Then you're not going to learn anything new, obviously. And so I said, maybe I should be quiet another day. And that went on. And I was learning so much about myself, about the people I lived around, my friends and my neighbors. I better do this for a week. And eventually, I ended up not speaking. I said, well, I'm going to do it for a year. And if everything is still the same way, I'll ask myself and I'll renew the vow, or I'll start speaking. Well, I didn't start speaking for 17 years.
Oh, wow.
I know that. Now, this is an environmental show, and John, we're going to get to your environmental work in a minute, but this...
Thank you.
We've got... I've got to get a sense of what it's... I don't know how to, you know, describe as best you can in words what it's like to be silent for 17 years and be kind of a sponge, in a sense. You're just absorbing information. Wasn't there times where you just wanted to offer your opinion or thoughts or feedback?
Wow. Thankfully, I had a banjo.
Okay. There we go. Music. You know, music. The role of music.
And,
okay.
Yeah. And music was a really good thing. You know, that song about music assuaging the savage beast. I think it's a true saying. But I listened to a lot of people, and I just felt that listening was the way to really learn about people. But not only people, but my environment, because you say this is an environmental show. And I was walking all this time and listening to my physical environment and the people around me. And it was life altering, life changing. And eventually I ended up walking across the United States, and I would stop and go to school without speaking. And I went to school in Oregon for my undergraduate degree, bachelor's in science. And then I went to, I returned to the Bay Area to learn how to build wooden boats, and found my organization called Planet Walk, which is a nonprofit environmental education organization. And then I took off walking around the world and up to Montana, well, up to Port Townsend, Washington, where I built my first boat, and rode that across Puget Sound to Bainbridge Island, and then walked across. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And all the way to Montana, I did a master's degree in environmental studies without speaking. And I wrote on a professional paper. It was War, Peace, and the Environment, Pilgrimage and Change. War, Peace, and Environment. Pilgrimage and Change, War, Peace, and Environment. And then on to South Dakota. I worked as a printer, and then to Madison, Wisconsin. And I was a fellow at the University of Wisconsin's Gaylord Nelson's Institute for Environmental Study, where I, still not talking, studied for my PhD. And all the way to the East Coast, where I started speaking again on the 20th anniversary of Earth Day, because what environment meant to me had absolutely changed from being about pollution and loss of species and habitat and climate change to be including people. Because, oh my God, can you imagine how many people I ran into walking across America? You know, and they were all different. You know, I mean, I went through blue states, purple states, yellow, green, whatever color state you could imagine, to get to the East Coast and start talking. And I realized, oh my gosh, people are really part of the environment. Hmm. And like, because of that, our first opportunity to treat the environment in a sustainable way, or even understand what we mean by sustainability, that was the new word, sustainability, was how we treat each other.
Right. So,
it's like, you know, if we oppress each other, if we exploit each other, being part of the environment, that's gonna manifest in the physical environment around us. You know, so environment to me became about human rights and civil rights and gender equality and economic equity and all the ways that us humans relate to one another.
Well, kind of coming full circle, you eventually got work with the federal government, I believe, working with the U.S. Coast Guard, or helped write the U.S. Coast Guard Oil Pollution Act of 1990.
Correct. Yes, I helped. You know, it was just amazing because when I was in Wisconsin studying for my PhD, I was already writing on oil spills because that was really what got me started in the environmental movement. And I was getting published already. And so the Coast Guard reached out to me and called up and, you know, asked to speak to me. And you know, they had to say, well, you know, yeah, John Francis, he's here, but he doesn't speak. He gave up speaking and was practicing a vow of silence. And they said, well, we just wanted him to come out to Washington, D.C. and help us write these regulations. And he said, well, I'm sure he would be happy to do that. But, you know, he doesn't ride in cars, so he'd be walking. And it's just, God, is there somebody normal at your university? You know, and eventually I
you showed up first.
They talked to my major professor who tried to explain everything. Did explain everything to him. And when I started speaking, they reached out to me again. And so I eventually got to Washington and worked at Coast Guard headquarters, writing oil pollution regulations. And it was just an amazing time for me. I still didn't ride in cars, but I did talk, which was a very helpful for them.
I like the fact that you broke your vow of silence on Earth Day, which I think Senator Nelson, Gaylord Nelson, was pivotal in helping to establish.
Yes.
Right. So
yes.
That's that connection there.
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of connections with Wisconsin and the Institute for Environmental Studies there. And one of them was, of course, Gaylord Nelson. And I am emeritus now as a professor and a board of visitors for the Nelson Institute. And so I got to learn a lot about Gaylord, and I know his family and Tia, his daughter, who's still there. And but there was also another famous person in the environment that studied at Wisconsin, and that was John Muir.
Wow.
John Muir.
Right.
And I'm sure he was considered crazy too. He walked from Florida to Wisconsin to go to school there. It's like I go, oh, yeah,
wow.
I guess there are all these similarities, huh?
Interesting.
Well, we've got another 6 or 7 minutes.
So right.
A lot more to cover. We haven't even touched on your the book, Planet Walk, but I do want to jump into the children's book you just published. Human Kindness, True Stories of Compassion and Generosity That Changed the World. What was the impetus behind writing that?
Well, you know, it was a good friend of mine who is a publisher, Christopher Lloyd. We spent a lot of time sailing on a boat out from the UK to the Grand Canary Islands as part of a recreation of Charles Darwin's trip around the world. And we became really good friends, and he got in touch with me and he said, John, would you write a book on kindness, a children's book on kindness? I said, Chris, what a great idea. Absolutely. And so it just happened just before COVID. And so I spent my time at home in writing this book and being able to research so many different things about kindness through the University of Wisconsin, their library. I could write, they would send me the books, I could send them back, and it was just an amazing time. And here I am being able to get up every morning, and such a practice, I keep practicing it, and think about kindness, you know? So it was a wonderful you know, juxtaposition of a lot of events there.
Oh, and so that book is available?
Definitely.
Okay.
Yes, it was published here in the United States September 6th. And, you know, you can get it at your local bookstore or Amazon or, you know, online at any of the booksellers.
All right. Now, the next thing is you're not done walking, if I understand correctly. You are actually planning a 4,000-mile walk from South Africa to, I think it's Ethiopia. This coming spring.
Yeah, I am looking at the logistics involved in that walk. I'm a National Geographic explorer. That happened as I walked, after I walking across the United States, I became not only a UN Goodwill Ambassador, and after I walked and I walked the length of South America with as a UN Goodwill Ambassador and some of Cuba, but as a National Geographic explorer, my hope is to walk starting at Cape Town, walking north through the Rift Valley, to join all the other National Geographic explorers that are doing work and had them come and walk with me and for me to go visit their work sites where they are working and all the way the length of Africa, you know, and that's my dream walk right now.
How do Nell and I join in?
Yes.
Seriously. Well, is it possible?
It's possible, but the first thing, I just returned from Tanzania, which was the birthplace of humankind in the sense that it's where we first stood up on two legs and started walking. So as the planet walker, going to Tanzania to where we began walking on this journey, this humankind journey, was really important. And we are doing two walks in Tanzania, which are fundraising for the larger walk starting in Cape Town. And those two walks begin in February of next year. But, you know, people who are interested can get a hold of me and we can tell them all about the walks in Tanzania, and they're going to help come up with the route and the mindset of the walk from Cape Town north as well. I mean, being a planet walker, this is called not only Planet Walk Africa, but Planet Walk World. We want planet walkers to be all over the world to walk with the spirit of kindness and generosity and to listen and learn, not that we're going to tell you how to do things, but I tell people, just walk and listen. Listen to people's stories.
And listen to nature.
Hey,
not for nothing, right?
Yes.
Right.
That's exactly right.
And last couple of minutes, if I understand, you live in the Cape May area right now?
I live in Cape May, New Jersey.
Yes, yeah. I'm born and raised in South Jersey, in Vineland, and was in Cape May last October.
Oh, my goodness.
I love it.
So you're a Jersey boy.
Can't you hear it in his voice?
You could take a vow of silence on that, John. Thank you. Yes. So I know where you live. I want to visit. I want to visit you. Seriously, I want to look into joining this walk in Tanzania. This is so fascinating. So many more questions, but we got to wrap up. How do people learn more about Planet Walk, your organization, your books, and this trip?
Well, you can learn about Planet Walk by looking at our website, which is planetwalk.org, www.planetwalk.org. You can contact me at john@planetwalk.org. And we are on the website of 1% for the environment, for the planet. That's it. 1% for the planet. Excuse me. I get to, yeah.
Okay.
So all those.
All right. And lastly, you know what, John? This would be perfect irony. You should have your own radio show. You have so much to say now. check out the Cape May NPR affiliate. Do that. That's what Nell and I did. They gave us a show.
Cape May White. Yes, yeah, sir.
That's right. John Francis, he is a professor of environmental studies, emeritus, and also the author of two books, among other things, Planet Walker, 17 Years of Silence, 22 Years of Walking, and the new children's book titled Human Kindness, True Stories of Compassion and Generosity That Changed the World. John, thank you so much for joining us and speaking with us on This Green Earth.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We will stay
absolutely
in touch. All right.
You can email us your thoughts, your comments, and your ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. We always want to talk about what you want to learn about.
That's right. That's where we run out of ideas every other week. Okay. The interviews for this show will be posted on the KPCW website later this morning.
You can also listen to the show anywhere you find your podcasts, including visiting the NPR podcast site and searching on the education page.
All right. Real quick, thanks again to John Francis for his great discussion. Planetwalk.org. Learn more about that.
And fascinating work and fascinating person. And of course, thanks to Professor Golson and his discussion about the new book, Silent Earth, Averting the Insect Apocalypse.
That's interesting. Silent Earth.
I know.
There's our theme
for the show. We discovered it.
We just figured that out. Great, Joe. Thanks again for joining us. Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City.
Tune in and listen like a local.